Again, so what I'll talk about today is stochastic inflation, and I think it was quantum Beck reaction as advertised, but it's the same thing. And my talk is based basically on two papers available on the web, and also something in preparation. And this thing in preparation will be next 10 minutes of my talk. So it's very much a work in progress, and I do not guarantee I'll say everything which is exactly correct. So in the last 10 minutes. So I'll first give you a very general introduction and motivation. Of course, I will not solve all of these problems. Nevertheless, as you all know, we now have a reasonably strong evidence for cosmic inflation, mostly based on this picture, which comes from WMAP, 3-year data. And the evidence is based on the fact that we have near Skelemann spectrum on cosmological perturbations, near spatial flatness, and cosmic microwave background radiation fluctuations are actually Gaussian. And of course, as you know, this has been recently disputed. Namely, there is a claim that here, very large L, there is some evidence for non-Gaussianity. However, this has to be confirmed by the WMAP team, so I would not take this. I have not crossed this as evidence yet. There is also dark energy, which causes acceleration of the universe. Basically, what you see here on this plot, I'm not sure you can actually see it very well. So this is the magnitude of supernova exploding at large distances, supernova type 1a, and this is the distance in redshift. So redshift 1. Is it? No, it's about 1 here. So between 0 and 1. So these are cosmological distances. And what you see here is, for example, this. I'm not sure I can even. There will be open universe somewhere here. And what actually this all points out? It points out that the supernova actually fainter than they should have been had the universe been open at, let's say, omega 0.3. And that can be explained by the fact that the universe is actually accelerating. So then all of this, and then you get this blue curve here, which lies basically on top of the point. So we have this is one piece of evidence. The other piece of evidence comes from here. So there is more or less now consensus that the universe is accelerating. And of course, the question is, what causes this acceleration? So my talk is going to marginally address that question as well. And the question of dark energy is closely related to the cosmological constant problem. And basically, we do believe that vacuum fluctuates. We also have some evidence for it. And one way of seeing that fluctuating vacuum should carry energy is simply to say that you have a finite volume. Take a field theory in a finite volume, L cubed, and go to reciprocal lattice in momentum space. So each point here is to good approximation like a harmonic oscillator. So that's the description of field theory. And these points actually extend to all of space. So there are infinitely many of them. Each of them carries energy E half. So according E is the energy given by Einstein's relation. And so, of course, that then you end up with infinite amount of energy. How do you get finite out of infinite? Well, you just say that the momenta cannot be arbitrarily large. So there must be some cutoff scale, how big they can be. In other words, there must be some minimum distance scale. This distance scale is given by the Planck scale. If that is so, then there should be some maximum momentum, which is all the Planck mass. And if that is so, then that would limit how big the vacuum energy can be. So basically, you would get vacuum energy to be of the order 10 to the 76 gigaelectron volt to the power 4. Now, this energy density contributes to the stress energy in such a way that it's proportional to the metric tensor. So if you actually look at Einstein's equation, then you see that then you can combine that type of contribution from the right-hand side of the equation, that these are matter sources, with the left-hand side. So that means there is a geometric cosmological term, and then there is this right-hand side. and you only observe this, so you only observe this linear combination of the two. And according to this dark energy observation, this is less than about 10 to minus 46 giganewton on to power 4. So the discrepancy of these two numbers is known as the gravitational hierarchy problem or the cosmological constant problem. So, in other words, we would like to understand this discrepancy in one way or the other. Moreover,
one point here. These are, of course, very naive calculations, so no one knows this discrepancy. But the treatment of quantum fluctuations depends very strongly on which type of frame for the method you are doing. So, from this complication in the Einstein frame, you do a similar calculation in different frames, you get very different results. So, I think it's really touchy for me. It's not easy, but you can just say, I put in a cutoff and it will be this type of calculator of.
But in this other frame.
Wait a minute. If you do it in another frame, then your Planck mass. I think this calculation is correct because it says that it started in Planck. If you go to a different frame, your Planck will start running.
Don't you have. Don't you have variation of Newton constant? We do have certain.
We should not discuss that because it will take, take away this power.
Yeah.
But I'm ready to discuss it at some moment.
Sure. Sure. I mean, I'm just presenting you the standard argument. Of course, the only way that you can actually probe this vacuum energy if you in some way couple it to some observer. So in other words, on its own, this is not. This doesn't yet prove it. So, and of course, this is one way of coupling it. But it's far from being proven that this part of the stress energy tensor actually does couple to G mu. So we actually have no proof for it. Having said that, now let's assume that there is a universe with some finite lambda and put in this universe all kinds of other matter fields. And let it evolve, and let's assume that this universe is a low entropy universe, that means it's nearly homogeneous. And the way this universe will evolve is that it's going to expand, and all other matter fields is going to they will dilute, and you're going to end up with the universe dominated by lambda. So, in other words, lambda is a classical late-time attractor. So, whatever you start with, you're going to end up with our universe, which is a classical attractor. The question I'll try to address today is whether it remains so in quantum theory. Yes. Any? Well, it's just you wait long enough, everything else redshifts away, and if lambda is zero, then of course it's zero. But if it's non-zero. So, and I will try to address it, this question two different ways. The first one is the stochastic theory of inflation. And I'll first introduce this historically, and then I'll give you our derivation of stochastic theory and try to explain what is this useful for. And why this is relevant for studying quantum back reaction. So this idea is due to Starobinsky and describes inflationary dynamics as a classical stochastic field with Markovian noise term, in fact generated by these quantum fluctuations. And so what we claim is the best way to view this theory is actually captures the leading logs in the scale factor for inflation dynamics. And it does so to all orders in perturbation theory. In other words, by solving this classical stochastic dynamics allows us to resolve perturbation theory. So this is a rather bold statement, and I'll try to argue that it is indeed correct. And so here is a little bit cartoon of this historical derivation due to Starobinsky and why it works. So if you take a massless minimally coupled scalar field and you put such a field in the Sitter space, then it's going to fluctuate. The Sitter space is kind of a model space for inflation. And you calculate two-point function, and the standard way of representing it is by the spectrum, which is defined here. And I can actually easily calculate, I solve the equation of motion for 5, and I can easily calculate this quantity. So this is what I get. So as you see here, it has this constant part, so proportional to h squared, and it has also a part that goes as k squared. In fact, this is just the k over a is the physical momentum. So it's physical momentum squared divided by the Hubble parameter squared.
On the left, what was the, you say perturbation expansion and what was it? Perturbation and what?
No, this is exact in the sitter.
No, but the statement above, two whole orders in
In some coupling parameter, yeah, depending on the theory.
So there's noise and interactions.
Yeah. So, but it's going to become clear, right?
When you have interactions, it will generate also fluctuations. You assume the noise is much larger than those fluctuations?
I'm not assuming anything. Well, you will see, okay.
What should we assume then?
No, I'm assuming some Lagrangian, of course, but...
This is a massless, minimally coupled theory.
No, this thing here is... No, this is not the theory I want to solve. This is just an example.
I'm just asking, that's for the massless...
Yes, this is the massless minimally coupled scalar. And basically, this part here, this k-squared part is... You know, on this plot here, but this logarithm of the physical momentum versus the logarithm of spectrum, so it has a k-squared behavior. So that means that this is conformal part of the spectrum, and this spectrum is present in all quantum fields, also in fields that fluctuate in this room, fermionic fields, etc. So it is well known. Of course, it can be cut off by the mass. But for a massless field, this is the spectrum how it looks like. And I will say that this spectrum here is quantum for all k. So it should be considered as quantum. But now what actually happens in this case, there is also this one here. And this one is there only because the universe is expanding. So there is an amplification or generation, if you wish, of scalar particles. And so it is actually seen in the spectrum as a break, and then you see this characteristic scale invariant type of spectrum. Of course, if the space-time is not really truly the sitter, but near the sitter, then this slope can change a little bit. Also, small mass can change the slope a bit. But anyway, this is just an idealization. The important point here is that in the infrared, this part, the scale invariant part, is actually much greater than k squared. So we've got this amplification. And Starobinsky's idea was somehow to cut this off and simply say at some scale which is below h, and only consider those modes, and simply say that these modes, considering these modes, is actually enough to describe dynamics, except for with one caveat. Do I have a black chalk somewhere, perhaps? If you actually look at what happens as a function of scale factor, and you look at the physical wavelength, the physical wavelength is proportional to the scale factor itself. So the physical modes of constant comoving lambda, this is comoving lambda, actually grow. And while on the other hand, during inflation, there is something which is called Hubble radius, which is roughly constant. And then this Starobinsky's cutoff scale it's actually a little bit above here. So I should probably plot it like this. So what you actually see here is if you start with some very ultraviolet mode, as time goes on, this mode is going to cross this scale here. And as it crosses it, it's going to have certain amplitude. So in fact, it's going to have certain distribution, like a Gaussian distribution, centered at zero. So it's going to what precisely its amplitude will be, we actually don't know. And so another mode, which has a slightly lower physical wavelength, bigger physical wavelength, is going to cross this scale later, etc., etc. So there will be modes constantly crossing this scale and appearing with certain amplitude that is drawn out of certain Gaussian distribution, which is actually given, the amplitude is basically given here by h squared over 4 pi squared of the width of that distribution. So what that means is that, so Starobinsky has realized that one can actually describe this as a noise term. So it's constantly kicking in the system. And where does it come from? Well, these modes originate from quantum fluctuation somewhere in the far ultraviolet. So the true origin is actually quantum fluctuations in the far ultraviolet. And so when I add this noise to that basically completes my picture of stochastic dynamics. So I have this, the dynamics of the infrared modes plus the noise coming from these modes crossing. Okay, so let's now, this is sort of just for you to get the intuitive picture what Stravinsky did and where the theory comes from. But now I'll try to be a little more rigorous, and so I work in the universe where line element is just that of Freeman-Robertson-Walker space-time, so there is a scale factor, a function of time, otherwise the space is flat, and there's a metric tensor in conformal time, so you can actually write it this way. So it's conformally related to the flat metric tensor. If you're under city inflation, the scale factor goes exponentially, or as 1 over eta in conformal time. And if I'm not in the city inflation, then this changes slightly. The action, for example, for mass scalar, I will also look some other theories later on. So it has a kinetic term, so this is covariant action, so it's basically unique. And so this kinetic term mass coupling to Ricci scalar and the potential. And when I vary this action, I get this operator equation. So by D, I denote this operator here, which is the tree-level operator acting on phi. And this part of the theory is linear, and we can actually solve it. But there is an interaction here, and there is some potential, and this is the derivative of the potential with respect to phi. So this is the interaction part, and once you include that, in general, we don't know how to solve this. And so there is, however, an approximation in which you can actually solve this theory, and I'll try to argue now that this approximation is precisely the stochastic theory of Stravinsky. So, but in order to proceed, let us integrate this equation. So in order to integrate it, we have to invert this operator, and inversion of this operator will give us retarded Green's function. So, and this phi zero here, it's a free solution that satisfies the equation d phi zero is equal to zero. So far I have not done, well, I'm formally integrated the equation, but actually I have not done anything because this equation is equally hard as this one. So, but this will be the starting point of my derivation. And so phi zero, as I said, it's d phi zero equals zero, so it satisfies certain linear differential equations. So as a result, I can actually expand it in terms of creation-relation operators. Since the space is homogeneous, I only have mode functions which are plane waves here. But in time, time translation invariance is broken, so there is some mode functions in time which can have a rather complicated time dependence. For the minimally massless coupled scalar field, where these parameters are zero, and in the city inflation, there is a well-known solution, which is called Bunch-Davis vacuum, which I write not as a function of time, but as a function of scale factor. So, but it doesn't matter. I mean, this is the solution I'm sure you've seen somewhere. And so this solution is rather simple. And in terms of, when it comes to the Green's function, this is a retarded Green's function, has a general disform, so I can again write it in terms of mode functions. That means these mode functions. And if I use Bunch-Davis vacuum, this is what I get. So I can actually find the exact solution in this case. Now there is a crucial step. So what we actually want is what actually appears for this as a consequence of scale invariance of the scalar field, when you actually calculate the correlator at coincidence, you actually get some infinite constant plus a term that grows logarithmically with the scale factor. You get some kind of secular term that grows. And so my statement is, of course, the full dynamics contains information about you know, solving this or that equation contains information about all of these leading all of these logs correctly. However, if you want to capture them, there is a much simpler theory that actually does that. And this theory is obtained in the following way. If I actually expand my phi zero or mode functions in powers of k over ha squared, in powers of k over ha, and in fact this is often known as the as number operator. We can associate this with the number operator because this is actually particle number in Bajdaev's vacuum in some loose sense. So if you do expansion of the Bajdaev's vacuum in these parameters, and actually then you can make the observation that all of these, which have higher powers of k, can never generate leading logs, can never participate in generation of leading logs, then you actually can drop them. In other words, number operator inverse has a norm which is not order logarithm of the scale factor, but it's sort of 1 at most. In other words, it's purely quantum. So it can never give you these infrared logs, which are a result of this infrared tail that is scale invariant. And similarly, I can do the same type of expansion of the retarding Greens function, and I will get all the corrections that go as the inverse of the number operator. And again, I can drop those because they can never generate leading logs. So how can retarded Green's function generate leading logs? Well, if you integrate certain interaction around some vertex, then you can actually generate from the retarded Green's function all the logs. But also this since A prime is in the past of A, so one can also show that this part of the term can also not generate leading logs. So only what you need to maintain in the retarded Green's function is actually this form, the leading order contribution to the expansion in powers of 1 over n.
So when you talk about leading logs,
Yeah. Dependence
on A or dependence on n?
What I mean is the following. There is a constant correction here. And this constant correction, when as time goes on, this grows, right? So this term becomes much greater than 1. But this term is order 1. So then I have a hierarchy between this one and that one. So if I wait long enough, late time dynamics will always be dominated by this term rather than that term. That's the statement.
Why do you call it quantum?
Because we are solving this equation.
Yeah, but it's a completely linear equation, so there should be no difference between classical and quantum, no?
No, this contains V prime.
Sorry. There is no V prime. No.
There is V prime.
V prime is behind, okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
But this curve is for the massless minimally coupled scale.
But no potential. V prime is again something linear in phi.
This behavior has nothing to do with the potential.
But right.
It's just again a constant times phi, no?
That's correct. Yes. So I'm interested in studying perturbation theory. It's where I have some interactions. For example, I have a lambda phi to the fourth theory, something like this. So V prime is lambda phi cubed.
Right.
So then I have.
But the question was about why the log is quantum. That has nothing to do with the potential.
Yes, but if I want to solve this perturbatively, then I will get I'll get diagrams like this coming from here. So I'll get, let's say, two vertex. So I have to integrate over these vertices and stuff like that.
On the level where you're discussing, there's no difference between quantum and classical because it's all linear.
Look,
perturbations have never appeared yet. Lambda has never appeared yet.
I'm discussing this equation. That's the equation I'm discussing. And now I'm saying phi zero, it's just a linear, it's just satisfies the equation d phi zero equals zero. And I'm saying the general solution is this one. But I'm not losing any leading log contribution if I truncate the mode function, if I drop those terms. That's what I'm saying. And therefore I'll do that. Then I have in that equation. In that equation, I also have. It's not fully consistent, perhaps, but it is. Yes, we will not solve a fully interacting theory for arbitrary mass. Okay. So there is a G retarded, and the G retarded also has this expansion. So that's the leading order term, and that one also captures the leading log. So the statement is then the following, that this Young-Feldman equation, the leading logs can be generated either by when you have pairs of free fields of coincidence, or if you have vertex integrations of this type, because G retarded can increase the power of logarithm by one. And the way I've truncated it, that means this leading contribution to the G retarded actually does capture this phenomenon here. So therefore it does capture leading log, that's the statement. You can also show that when you do perturbation theory on the Young-Feldman equation, you can then show that counter terms, because they are suppressed by more powers of coupling constant, can only give subleading logs and therefore can be dropped. Basically what one then can say, one can make the following statement, that if I break the field into the ultraviolet part and the infrared part, whereby by infrared part I mean I actually take into account only the modes up to the Hubble scale. So in other words, I'm only taking account of this one in the power spectrum. And moreover, I expand the mode functions such that I only keep the leading contribution. So then the mode function expansion reduces to that form. Now, this is my approximation to phi zero. If you actually take a dot of this, you realize that the only dependence on time comes from here. And this will then give you delta function if I take a dot here. And it's not then hard to show that the two-point function of phi dot will have no memory in the sense that it will portion to delta of t minus t prime. So for different times. And moreover, because this is of course quantum field, it fluctuates, but since this describes now some super Hubble scales, in this approximation, the field fluctuates always in the same direction. So in other words, creation and elation operators generate fluctuations always in the same direction. As a consequence, phi zero commutes at arbitrary space-time separations. And that means that this approximation has effectively made the theory classical. So that basically explains how we've started with the quantum theory. We made certain expansion or approximation, and we've arrived effectively at the classical theory. And moreover, if I insert into the Young-Feldman equation,
what if the source of equivalence here, if you just have a massless scalar field, why the fluctuation would be equivalent?
Yeah. So I drop.
Until you add some other interaction.
Yeah, so I dropped all the terms that are suppressed by N inverse. That decoheres the system.
It's just dropped the coherence terms, that's all.
Yeah. That's what I've done, yeah. But I've dropped them because they can never generate leading logs. That's justification. So I'm not worried here about the coherence, I'm worried about dynamics. And I want to keep the leading terms in dynamics. So in other words, if you, for example, have a, and you're going to see it later in a moment, scale electrodynamics, to each loop or to each E squared, there will be one logarithm of the, at most one logarithm of the scale factor. And then you have to sum, if you want to calculate certain quantity, typically, typical dependence will be of that type, where these are the appropriate coefficients, order one, for that quantity. And this will be the perturbation theory that we would like to solve. And so I will argue that this stochastic technique actually allows us to calculate these quantities. Now, if I take the retarded Green's function from my transparency, well, from before, so that means just this leading order contribution to the retarded Green's function, and plug this in into the Young-Feldman equation, and you realize that I can integrate over space because I have a delta function, and I have a theta function that actually limits my time integration. And so when I plug this in here, I'll just have a theta function and integration over time. And then when I take the time derivative of it, integration over time will drop out, and I will get this equation. So this is the Langevin dynamics for the quantum field phi. And this phi zero is the field which has this type of correlation. So the phi zero is the field actually that gives noise to the system. Phi zero dot is the noise, and then this is therefore the leading log dynamics. So the statement is now that these two equations, when solved together, actually correctly capture to any correlators leading logarithm dynamics. For example, you know, correlators of that type. And the question is how you solve this theory. And in general, if you have some function now of on the scalar field and expectation value that you would like to know what it is, then in general you need to know the distribution function, probability density rho as a function of phi and time, and you just integrate over phi, this f of phi, and this is the stochastic theory expression for that operator. Of course, this equality should be understood only in the leading log sense. And how do I solve for rho? Well, rho turns out to satisfy the Fokker-Planck equation, which has this form. And so if I solve that equation, then I can in principle calculate any correlator. For example, what Starobinsky and Yokohama have found, there is a very simple late time limit for inflationary theories. If you assume that late time limit of rho exists and it's time independent, and if you assume that H is roughly constant and it's field independent, then the solution to this equation, I only have the right-hand side, so it's easily solved. So it has that form. So in other words, this late-time behavior of distribution function, so you have a potential of that type. So rho is just distribution of phi around the origin. And if phi is V is non-Gaussian, then this distribution will be accordingly non-Gaussian. And this is the solution for lambda phi to the fourth. Of course, you can for example ask what is then the story of eternal inflation? And the story of eternal inflation is that this assumption actually breaks down. So H is not constant, but H is actually given by phi. And if I actually try then to solve this, if I just naively put in the solution here, I will realize that h to the 4 goes v squared. So, and then I'll get naively a solution that I cannot normalize, so I cannot find rho 0. In other words, that the field will be pushed away from the origin rather than pulled into the origin. So I would say that from this point of view, there is something to eternal inflation. But of course, eternal inflation is a more complicated problem than that, because here I've studied just, I've shown you how to deal with the scalar field, but I have not told you anything how to deal properly with gravity. So the question is, what happens if you have more than just a scalar theory? And in this case, the statement is you have to identify the so-called passive and active fields. And the passive fields are those which cannot be stochasticized. And they have a, roughly speaking, conformal spectrum. So they have a spectrum that goes as k squared for all k. And such a field is quantum both in the infrared and ultraviolet, and that's why it cannot be stochasticized. But the question is, what can you do with such a field? And in fact, you can still stochasticize this theory if you can integrate out the active field, the passive field. And an example I'm going to study today is scalar electrodynamics, and that. The passive field here is the photon field, because the photon field conformally couples to gravity and therefore has a conformal spectrum for all k. So the spectrum goes as k squared. While the scalar will be massless, so it has a scale invariant spectrum in the infrared. And therefore it's the active field. So the active field is the field that can be stochasticized. And so the program is just written here. So you basically integrate out the passive field, you split the active field into the infrared ultraviolet parts, you drop the ultraviolet part because it cannot generate leading logs, and then you stochasticize the resulting infrared scalar theory. So that's an example. So the question is, of course, you can ask, why do we do that? Because once we have the stochastic version of that theory, we can actually calculate any correlator to any loop order. That's a statement. Quite a bold statement. Second, this theory here is actually resembles very much gravity in the sense that it has a derivative interaction, just like photon does interact with scalar. And it also has passive and active fields, just like gravity does. So the gravity, for example, has a vector mode that is basically conformal, just like the photon. And scalar electrodynamics, how does it look? I'm sure you've seen this. So it has a kinetic term for the photon, kinetic term for the scalar, and it has these other terms, interaction term for scalars, and there's covariant derivative through which scalar and the photon interact. But the important point here is that the photon appears at most quadratically in this action, and therefore I can integrate it out by the method of path integrals. And when I do that, in principle I can integrate it out, put it that way. Integrating this diagrammatically corresponds to actually solving this one loop bubble diagram, but which has some insertions, which are actually due to the fact that the photon effectively has a mass because phi has a non-zero value in different points in space and time. So this is now the infrared part of the scalar. And to evaluate this determinant, I have to evaluate trace log of this operator here. This is the photon operator. So it has this form in general it has this form, and one can actually solve the propagator associated with this photon operator, for example, in the Sitter space, assuming phi is equal to constant. And this assumption is legitimate in the sense that it captures leading log, and I can try to explain why that is so. And when one actually does this, stochastic inflation theory actually allows to resume perturbative expansion of various correlators and leading log accuracy. For example, stress energy tensor, which has this form, we can actually calculate it. The leading log approximation has actually this form. And perhaps I should give you one remark why this is actually legitimate to assume so that this phi is actually constant and calculate the associated propagator for the massive vector gauge boson in the Sitter space. The reason is because if I perform an expansion in this parameter, I'll get different integrals that also involve integrations of phi star. But to leading log accuracy, I can actually pull this phi phi star out of the integrations. And then I can resum the series. It's just a geometric series. And when I do that, this is actually equivalent to assuming that phi phi star are constant, space-time independent. And then later, after I solve for the theory, I can actually reinsert the space-time dependence of these fields. So if you want to see this argument in a little bit more detail, you can actually ask me private how it works. But so far, this calculation is actually rigorous when it comes to capturing the leading log behavior. And this is a little bit basic transparency. So, but there are two transparencies of results, and I will not go in detail through the results. Basically, to get the stochastic theory of scalar electrodynamics, you have to evaluate this determinant. And this determinant is nothing but trace log is equal to minus the trace log of the propagator, photon propagator, in that background, right? And when you do that, you get a certain correction to the effective potential. And that correction in general is divergent. So we've done this in dimensional realization technique because this doesn't break any of the symmetries of the problem. So we've used counter terms for
the coupling constant
of coupling to reach a scalar and remove that divergence. And we have also renormalized the theory in such a way that at zero, V and V prime are both remain zero. And I think this sort of answers one of the questions, why do we assume that theory is massless? Well, this is the only thing we know how to do here, because these logs appear, strictly speaking, only when the scalar is massless. When the scalar has a mass, then a large mass, then there won't be any logs. So these conditions, the renormalization conditions, are such to guarantee actually that the scalar will be remain nearly massless even after the photon has been integrated out. Okay, and indeed you can actually these two conditions actually and removal of the divergent terms uniquely specify this potential, and therefore we claim that this potential is physical in that respect. And now what you can see here is potential is a function of Z, and rather complicated function. It goes through an integral of the gamma functions here of certain quantity mu, and mu is given in terms of square root of Z, and Z is something like a photon mass scale by the by H, by the Hubble parameter.
Worry you that you classify all your contributions by a term that only appears if you have an infrared singularity massless mode? Let's have some.
We can only study those theories.
And it tells you that this term that appears only for massless theories.
Okay, in inflation.
You have to resum these logs, for instance.
Yes, so in inflation, if this is the inflaton, you know that this must be the satisfied for the inflaton. And that's the condition also we assume here. So in that sense, we are not studying a non-realistic case. In fact, what you do know is that if this is not satisfied, you will not get nearly scaling on a spectrum. So that's actually a physical condition, I would say. I don't know, does it answer your question? You see, from all I can say, this is good chaotic inflationary potential. And it comes from physical theory. The original scalar has no potential whatsoever. This potential is solely generated by integrating out the photon. But it can inflate the universe. Of course, that's perhaps some fine-tuning problem. But then, and because of these conditions imposed, this is then satisfied in the end. Yeah, we get this potential, and that potential, you know, it's as far as I can see, it's perfectly good stochastic inflationary potential.
What happens if if I take the value for phi to be zero?
Well, you just get zero. I mean, the potential looks something. Okay, here I plotted it. So this is the potential, and what happens if you if I now solve my Fokker-Planck equation, I'll get certain that this potential will generate a late time certain probability for the scalar. So in fact,
the scalar is new
from this respect to the photon?
Yeah, your pi is a gauge singlet.
Pi is a gauge singlet.
Yeah.
So no, it's charged.
Charged, but then we get a huge full money. I mean, then I do not see why you get a potential that is only proportional to h to the 4. Just quantum fluctuations for a charged scalar field give you a positive potential.
Yes, you get this as well.
Okay, we have everything proportional to h to the 4.
You want to take the
flux. Oh, no, no, there is z, which goes as 1 over h squared. So, you know, if you have a z squared term, it's pi to the 4. Sorry. And there is a reason, I mean, this is really, phi is really a function of z. And here, in the ultraviolet limit, when phi is much greater than h, this actually gives you log. Phi to the fourth log. The Coleman-Weinberg log.
Coleman-Weinberg.
Yes, yes. In the limit when z gets big. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Because of so you can then calculate based on this, you can stochasticize the theory and calculate rho phi of t, the distribution, probability distribution for the scalar, the late times. You can of course calculate it at a finite time if you want. But so we have done it the late times. So that means that somehow field is distributed around the origin.
Phi is massless or massive?
We started with the massless, and we also imposed this normalization condition that remains massless. But
so phi is effectively a phi direction, essentially, in case.
But it contains phi to the fourth, etc.
Sorry?
It contains phi to the fourth, phi to the sixth, phi to the eighth vertices.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, in that sense, it's not completely flat.
What Coleman-Weinberg always produces a master for the
scalar field. But he puts it in by hand.
Yeah, we choose
a... But he says it's zero. It's fine-tuned. Yeah, maybe
it's fine-tuned.
Yeah. Okay,
fine. So once we know rho, we can calculate expectation value of t mean u. And the term proportional to g mean u we call Vs. And that one has this form. So this is not exactly the effective potential, but it has certain relation to it, which I've given here. Now, it turns out Vs is important because Vs actually tells you how much the energy of the vacuum changes due to the fact that, due to the existence of this field, which is distributed this way. And Vs is a function of z, it's given here. So it starts at zero again, but it has a negative dip here. And in fact, the solution here, since the potential is a function of z, the width is naturally of the order of 1 over e. So that's the natural width of this distribution here. And then you can see here that this field is going to pick a negative contribution in the energy density. So in fact, the contribution to the energy density in scalar electrodynamics is negative. And if you not want, if you try to calculate perturbatively what actually happens, then you see that the leading behavior at order e squared, you get e squared log a with some constant in front. And this is in d dimensions. So this is the scalar contribution to the stress energy, and this is the photon contribution to stress energy. Again, you see that there is an e squared log a term. But as I said, after a long time, you can actually, you know, this is just the first term in this expansion, but they are higher order terms. We can calculate all of them. And moreover, by solving the Fokker-Planck equation at late times, we can actually resum this series. So, when you actually do that, the resum result is this. So, the expectation value of Vs is minus 0.6 times this characteristic number, h to the fourth. And how do I explain that? Well, the perturbative result will tell you that this should be suppressed by e squared log a. In general, it should be suppressed by e squared. But the reason why it's not is because what actually happens here is log A grows roughly to 1 over E squared. And then it stops growing. So such that log A actually cancels E squared, such that this whole thing becomes order 1. So summing, resumming perturbation theory actually corresponds to resumming just numbers order 1. And the result actually shows that. So, of course, having that, that means that that there's some change in the cosmological term, and the corresponding change is actually minus 0.6 times h squared g newton. This is the relative change in lambda. And for grand unified scale inflation, this is about 10 minus 12. So even though this is non-perturbatively large result, it is still a tiny change in lambda. So you can say, well, perhaps you can now go home. I mean, it's. But at least, you know, we have now shown that these worrying logs that grow, they actually don't grow forever. They only grow to up to such a value to compensate for the smallness of the coupling constant. And then the resulting series can be summed, and the sum gives you something which is order 1. So it's not a big number. We have also calculated mass. You can also do it by similar techniques. It's certain operator averaged, and we get 3.38 squared. Again, the photon mass is non-perturbatively big. And again, you see from this definition that since phi is typically order 1 over e, so you can actually see it from this distribution. So this 1 over 2 times 1 over e cancels e squared, and you get something order 1 here. Perturbatively, when you calculate photon mass, you get order E result, E suppressed result. But this is non-perturbative result. However, scalar remains perturbatively light, so you can also calculate expectation value of the relevant operator, and you find that it's suppressed by the coupling constant.
And your masses are all non-zero. Would they not cut off anyhow your logarithms in the infrared?
Yes, that was precisely, that's a good point, yeah.
Then you do not get them.
Yes.
These are not really very large logarithms anyhow.
So yes, so...
it's never going to be 1 over e squared.
So the thing is that this mass here is actually dV effective. D phi star. And then expectation value of this object. So... So what this is telling us basically is that this, since this remains perturbatively small, I think it's justified to keep assume that the field is massless.
No, because the log, which is log e squared, and not 1 over e squared.
Where do you get log e squared?
The ln a will be cut off. This will not remain in ln a. It will be cut off in the infrared by m squared.
But it's not.
It's not. If you have massive fields, then it's cut off by the mass term. And this is what always happens. Yeah, all infrared divergences are cut off by mass terms. So you get log m squared.
Well, okay, so...
Well, it's much smaller than 1 over e squared. I take your value of a.
Yes, but this mass, I mean, this is the definition of it. So it's actually generated by these tails in the distribution.
But whenever we do resummations in thermal field theory or whatever, it's always a physical mass that matters. So if you want, if you want to keep in your computation a massless field, even though the physical mass is non-zero, this always brings you big errors. I mean, if you have a real mass, will be cut off.
I mean, this quantity here we keep zero, v prime. So this is the actual derivative here at the origin is zero.
Yeah. For the fluctuations.
But that, I think this is that quantity. That is zero.
Is your potential function of phi or of z? What notation did you use?
Because I have confused. Well, it's function of phi through z, because z is this.
Whatever happens, if you have a physical mass that will cut off your infrared logarithms, now
Yes, yes,
A,
yes.
The
no, I agree with you, yes. Yes.
To compute at the end, the physical
mass yes.
is not zero.
Yeah. Yeah.
This will replace your log A.
Yeah, I agree, yeah, yeah. That's one, yeah,
the log
sure.
M squared,
sure.
I'm just saying log M squared is much smaller than 1 over E squared.
Perhaps that's true, but I mean, the solution to this stochastic theory gives us this result. I mean, this is the situation, so I don't know what else to say.
How do I really integrate the photon mass on scales larger than the size of the Hubble patch? What exactly does it mean in this calculation? And I can define the photon mass inside my Hubble patch, I can understand it. We do it always in QED, also in QCD.
Yeah. I mean, this field doesn't vary very much inside the Hubble radius.
Yeah.
So it's nearly constant. So you can locally define it.
But this mass which you have written is on scales larger than my Hubble patch.
Yes.
So how do I interpret what exactly is...
Yeah, averaging is done over...
On scales what?
I mean, there is not, strictly speaking, it's...
There's scale dependence here, so...
Yeah, perhaps there is.
But the question is, how seriously can I take this photon mass? Because based on this,
it's
you're arguing that you get a negative contribution in your cosmological constant.
I mean, it's just a quantity of this type. I mean, it's a stochastic quantity, so I cannot say that...
It depends on the size on the box, my inference.
Yes, but here I have not cut off. I don't think that it will depend very much on the size of the box. Yeah. Let me just say in the last 5 minutes an alternative approach to the question of back reaction in Friedman-Robertson-Walker spaces. And here the idea is, well, let's just calculate one loop. This one loop bubble, but let's not do it in the sitter background. Let's do it in some more general background. Ideally, you would want to do it in the background where scale factor is completely unspecified. But of course, you cannot solve this bubble in a completely unspecified background. Instead, we're going to actually do it in Friedman-Robertson-Walker spaces with constant equation of state. That will be the assumption. And so, in other words, you know, these are my classical Friedman-Robertson-Walker equations, and the second equation, this one here, actually can be rewritten this way. So there is this slow roll parameter epsilon inflation, which is minus h dot of h squared, and this is also related to w, which is p over rho. So that relation actually follows from here. And when W is constant, then epsilon is also constant. For example, if you have radiation-dominated era, W is 1/3, so epsilon is 2. In matter era, W is 0, epsilon is 3/2. And in inflation, epsilon is close to 0. So these are all cases where this is basically valid assumption. And people who do slow roll inflation in models, they actually basically say we are expanding in powers of epsilon and keeping only leading order in epsilon. But in fact, also they are assuming that epsilon dot is order epsilon squared. And that's basically also what we assume here. So, and if I drop this order epsilon dot corrections, then we can actually solve for the propagator, and it has this form. And you will recognize here the hypergeometric function. The new parameter here has a rather complicated form, and you see the dependence on epsilon. So there is epsilon square, and there is also a non-perturbative dependence. Well, this one of epsilon dependence here. But the lesson to learn here is that this epsilon dependence here is like an effectively field acquires a mass due to the fact that there is an epsilon dependence here. Because the mass term would contribute as minus m squared over 8 squared if you were to add it here. So so in other words, we can actually treat effectively mass scalar and also gravitons in expanding space-times by this propagator now where there is as if they have a certain effective mass. And this quantity y, it just turns out to be, you know, also very useful for Friedman-Robertson Walker spaces. In the city space, this is just very, you know, it is very much related to the invariant distance between two points. But in Friedman-Robertson Walker space, it doesn't have that meaning. Nevertheless, it is a useful quantity in terms of which you can actually express the Rolland propagator. Now, this is just the scalar propagator. We have also done it for the graviton propagator, and I will not bother you with this because it looks even more complicated than this one. But the main point here is now we can actually calculate the Basel diagram with this. And the statement is perhaps the scalar propagator actually resums the logs of the scale factor. And why would that be? Well, if you actually, what this h here is, you can actually combine the scale factors with this h, and you realize that the dependence on delta of a, that h depends on time in the following sense. It's h0 a to minus epsilon. And if I now expand this in powers of epsilon, I'll get a leading order in epsilon, I'll get the logarithm of a. And so you now see that somehow this h has absorbed one of these log a. And so this is the basis, very vague basis for this statement that this scalar propagator actually resums the logs. So let's see how the actual calculation goes. Well, we have gone through a rather painful experience in trying to do this calculation. But in the end, we've decided that this is the best way. So you write the bubble contribution like trace log of the operator as the contribution to one loop effective action. And you cannot really evaluate that in general, but what we know how to do is we know how to evaluate the derivative with respect to the scale factor. And when you do this, you'll get some divergent contribution. Well, it turns out that the divergent contribution can be completely absorbed in the counter term, R squared counter term. Not completely. The divergent part of it can be completely absorbed. And so we have done that. We have removed the divergence. And what we obtain is something like this. So as you see here, we actually get an h to the fourth term, and which you actually cannot remove by any of the known counter terms. And you also get h to the h squared h dot times log h term, which you also cannot remove by any of the counter terms. And this result here, the renormalized result, can be now inserted into the one-loop Einstein equation, and this is the one-loop correction to it. And if this is conformal time, this deviation is effect to A as a function of conformal time, the resulting Einstein equation is actually the trace equation. So it has this form. Of course, once you have the trace equation, you can also ask the question, how do I get the second Einstein equation? And you can actually get it through assuming that the quantum part must also obey energy conservation on its own. And from there, you can actually indeed recover the second equation as well. So, and in fact, the work is related to the work of Motul and collaborators. Because...
saying that's the trace anomaly?
Well, yeah, I mean, this h to the fourth term here that we actually get when we subtract the divergence here is actually the trace anomaly, what I think. And but we also get this extra term, log h, which we don't get in trace anomaly. And the reason why you don't get that, because we have this background, which is known, which is, you know, non-Minkowski background, and as a result of that, you get this log term. And now, as I said, by using conservation of energy for the quantum part, you can recover second Friedman equation, and this is how they look. And here I dropped the R squared term, actually, contribution. It can in principle be also there, I just dropped it. So you see there is an a squared h dot log h term, and there is a h to the fourth term. And let's just for simplicity drop the h to the fourth term. And if you do that, so I'm now jumping. What you've seen on previous transparency was for the scalars, but now this is for gravitons. So the resulting equations are exactly the same, except for these coefficients are slightly different. So if I now just take this log term, I can actually integrate this equation, and this is what I get. And what's interesting here is, so I'll assume that, if I assume that lambda is zero, then of course classical behavior is just given by the W. So if W is zero, it's just the universe that goes behaves like this. You know, you get H is 2/3 t for W equals zero, for example. So this is the classical behavior. The question is, how does it change? And this is this green curve. So the red curve is the one that includes quantum correction. But what you actually, this is a function of time. So the bottom line is that late time behavior is essentially indistinguishable from that formula. So these two curves fall on top of each other. The correction basically looks like H squared quantum is the classical part, and then 1 plus order G Newton over T squared log G Newton over T squared type of term. So, you know, as time goes on, this becomes smaller and smaller. So the correction indeed becomes very, very small. What's curious is that at very early times, this equation gives you a finite answer for H at t equals zero. So H doesn't go to infinity, but instead it goes to some finite value. Of course, you would like to say, perhaps quantum corrections do limit how big H can grow. But the only thing I have to say about this maximum H business is that this is one loop artifact. And this behavior can completely change if you include 2, 3 loops, etc. So it is not to be trusted. So I don't want to make a big deal out of it. Now, if you actually solve, these are sort of the curves in the presence of lambda. The lambda is non-zero, and lambda is very big. So G Newton times lambda is order 10 minus 1. So you see, this is the classical behavior. So initially there is a big difference, but at late times, this curve and this curve almost become indistinguishable, except that there is a small offset. This offset is again order change in H by order G Newton times lambda. So there is a small correction at late times, but essentially. So what we're actually checking here is whether H goes to square root of lambda over 3. So this is late time attractor. And indeed, this is late time attractor with some tiny little shift, which is suppressed by G Newton times lambda. But otherwise late time attractor is actually obeyed. So that means that this one loop correction seems to lead not to big differences. And the city space is still late time attractor up to this small shift, or the G Newton times lambda shift. Of course, you would like to know what happens in two loops, and this is much harder calculation. We actually don't know. But there might be some logs on the scale factor that appear in two loops. And perhaps this is my last transparency. So I don't want to keep you much longer. But there is something very strange that we actually see. And if you now assume that you have a universe that is filled with relativistic matter, and relativistic matter is epsilon equals 2, so this is W equals 1/3. So, but it also contains a little bit of lambda and a little bit of non-relativistic matter, and you let it on its own to cool. So epsilon has to decrease continually from 2 to towards 0, towards late time attractor. But when you actually solve this equation, you will actually see something else happens. These d gamma functions that appear in the equation of motion actually have singularities at those points. And the highest singularity appears at epsilon equals 3/2. So this is the highest singularity. And if I just naively solve this equation in the vicinity of this singularity, what will happen is the following: that epsilon goes from 2 towards smaller values, but it never passes singularity, so it gets stuck there. So this is the equation you solve, and what you find is so that this h, which is a scale h, it should go to 1. But as you see, it doesn't go to 1, it goes to 0 at late times. In other words, if I plot 3ht over 2, and if this was matter era universe, it should asymptote to 1. And indeed, it does. So in other words, this universe, even though it has a non-zero lambda, it actually asymptotes towards matter-dominated universe. And anyway, I will. This is a mathematical result, and we're still trying to understand the physical meaning of this. So, why is that so? I mean, I can actually see it also from the mod equations that there is the singularity. You know, the matter field mod equation.
But this seems to contradict what you said before about the thing being small.
Yes. So exactly. Yeah. That's important. You see this prefactor here. So this function have poles. One of the poles is as epsilon equals 0 of the d gamma functions.
I don't understand in terms of poles, but in your previous slide, you told us that the reaction
okay.
was small.
Yeah. So in the previous slide, I assumed that I started with a universe with a small epsilon, which is already accelerating.
Uh-huh.
And that one asymptotes to epsilon equals 0 without any singularity.
Uh-huh.
And what you actually can see here is you see that this one, when I expand this around epsilon equals 0, I will get indeed 1 over epsilon from here. But this prefactor is actually contains epsilon, which will cancel 1 over epsilon. So everything is smooth around epsilon equals 0. However, epsilon equals 3/2, singularity is not cancelled by the prefactor.
Epsilon is small around
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Well, in radiation era, epsilon is 2.
No, epsilon is just the parameter, which 3
yes.
halves, 1 plus.
So, right. So that's important. We have actually calculated this propagator initially for small epsilon, but this result, you see, it has 1 over epsilon behavior, so it's true for any epsilon. Epsilon is constant, that's the approximation.
It's just h dot over h throughout the epsilon.
Right. My assumption is epsilon is constant, but it can be big. I have not assumed here in this propagator, it doesn't assume that epsilon is small. This is actually an unpublished result, so but the paper will come out very soon. Yeah, but right. I mean, it's not very difficult to derive it, and it's valid for any epsilon.
But what does it have to do with poles and epsilon?
Well, when you plug this in propagator and into the bubble evaluate the coincidence, you will actually the finite part of it will. You see, these gamma functions here in front will generate d gamma functions. Which and the gamma functions have poles and integers. So each of these poles could correspond to certain epsilon. The biggest epsilon for which there is a pole is 3/2.
So that's just the Pythagorean
theorem. Exactly. And actually, if you write the equation for the pressureless fluid for the conformally scaled case, you will get d eta squared plus k squared minus a double prime over a. So this quantity here is minus 2 over eta squared.
You're saying that the one loop diagram is enhanced if I do this, this propagated here
yes.
on here.
Yes.
But just do it in
yes.
the method of
yes.
you would say the one loop
yes.
big. Is very big.
That's what I'm saying. And you can see that from here, that this matter-dominated universe, W equals 0, you get this minus 2 over eta squared. If you look at W equals minus 1, you also get minus 2 over eta squared. So you get exactly H Bunge Davis. I mean, the solution is exactly the same. And when you try to calculate the propagator, you hit the same singularity as you do for the massless minimum coupled scale. So it's precisely the same type of behavior. And I was thinking that I can remove this singularity by twiggling with the Bogoliubov, this not Bogoliubov, but coefficients for different modes. I can choose them such to remove that singularity, but that's impossible. So as soon as you enter matter era, the singularity will appear. But of course, if you have a little bit of relativistic matter, then you will be never really at that singular point. I mean, W will be always small, non-zero, and then you will not get 2 here, but you will get some number which differed from 2 by a small amount. So this singularity, I think, is there. It's just...
Physically, what exactly... What's your statement that... in an atom-dominated epoch, might that reaction
interact? I'm saying naive calculation in an atom-dominated epoch gives that. Now the question is whether I believe that this is the physical result. And my answer is, I don't. And before I start believing in this, we have to make several checks. And check number one is that these are the scalar singular points appear exactly in the same place where the graviton singular points appear. So, and you know that in the universe, expanding universe, the matter fluctuations and gravitational fluctuations do couple. And they might couple in such a way that these singularities exactly cancel. That's a possibility. So we have to check that possibility. But before we can check it, we have to construct the proper propagator that actually describes that mixing between matter fluctuations and gravitational fluctuations. We don't have that yet. And the second possibility is, like, even if that doesn't happen, this propagator is constructed, strictly speaking, in the configuration space where only H and H dot are non-zero. And in principle, there is H double dot, etc., etc., higher derivative terms. And it could be that this singularity is just one point in configuration space. You never really hit it. You just go around it somehow.
Change a lambda-dominated universe to make it effectively looking like that radiation.
That's a very strong statement.
That's a very strong statement. And this has nothing to do with epsilon equals theta.
The one-loop back reaction, no, my statement is the following. The scalar fluctuations, one-loop back reaction around epsilon 3/2, so W equals 0, is big. And I think that's a correct statement.
The lambda-dominated universe is not close to the W equals 0.
That's true.
It's not close.
What I'm making the following statement. If I start with universe that has epsilon equals 2 and certain amount of lambda, and when epsilon decreases, it will not pass the point 3/2. It's going to get stuck there. It will not approach late time. That's the naive calculation. It will not approach the late time epsilon goes to 0 universe. So that is the statement. But that statement could be completely an artifact of our not taking into account the coupling of gravitational and matter fluctuations. That's statement number one. Or even perhaps epsilon dot is important. Perhaps the final dot takes you around the pole or something. I don't know.
For the former, would you expect it to depend on the number of matter species?
That's a good point. That's a good point. Yeah, because only the adiabatic mode couples, and the ones that are orthogonal should not couple. Yeah. No, I think that's a very good point. Yeah. Okay, yeah, so if you calculate, just calculate the spectrum for those, you know, for the solution associated with these modes, the spectrum is exactly the same looking as the one that you get for the scale, for the Sitter space. It has, it has this flat part. You see, it scales away as 1 over a cubed, and that's, you would think, yes. Yes, it scales away as 1 over a cubed, and you would think, therefore it's irrelevant. But the point about one-loop calculation in dimensional regularization, perhaps it's unphysical, I don't know. In dimensional regularization, this rescaling of the wave function does not contribute to the one-loop. To the actual physical effect. It does not give you. It's something that you subtract in dimensional regularization. So, I don't know, are there any other questions here?
We will have an organizational meeting right after this call for the next week's